Once he staved off her hyperventilation, he continued. Nobody expects you to know all the things. It's not like there's going to be a big test. Start with the bands you already know, or with some of these playlists I made for you. As for the rest of it... Cautious optimism wrinkled his brow. Wikipedia's a good place to start. He pulled up the website and explained how it worked. Maybe do a quick overview of each decade first. As she clicked around, she bobbed her head slowly. Seems a little less overwhelming. You got this. Just learn a little something new every day. And let me show you modern conveniences once in a while. Though they can be inconvenient sometimes. I spent 2 hours picking out a new pillow the other day. 2 hours? How many pillows are there? Too many. The curse of plenty. But we'll save online shopping for another time. And we'll need to talk about your money at some point. But I don't want your head to explode. For now, give iTunes a chance. He held out the MacBook until she nodded and took it from him. Holla if you need anything. You've got a few hours before your mother comes by for dinner. After we eat, we'll watch Purple Rain. What? It's a movie. You're gonna love it. She did love Purple Rain, as well as Back to the Future, and all the 80s John Hughes movies Kenzie chose. Next week, we'll start on the 90s. Two words. Pulp Fiction. While she got accustomed to cable, DVR, and Netflix, she preferred he take the reins of what they watched so she could focus her exploratory energy on music. After the initial intimidation of her iTunes collection, she rejoiced at catching up on decades of discographies from her favorite musicians, though she still often opted for the lush crackle of a vinyl record. But she also gave the playlists a chance, which enlightened her on some new genres that emerged in recent decades. She warmed to the rhythm and cadence of hip-hop, the raw growl of grunge, the mechanical seduction of electronica. Heeding Kenzie's advice, she used Wikipedia to get up to speed on key events of the past decades, following many rabbit holes when a particular person or event sparked her curiosity. She became proficient at online research, though she resisted the urge to look up her old friends again. Instead, she distracted herself with decades of scientific and technological advancement, historical conflict, and popular culture. The loss of time was less painful when it was less personal. Though the deaths of musicians she admired saddened her. Freddie Mercury, Joe Strummer, all four original Ramones. Lou Reed's passing especially stung. While she took walks with Kenzie in the park every other day, she stayed in the rest of the time, glued to her laptop or tablet, picking a different room of the house each day to settle in. Kenzie joined her when he didn't have calls or errands, and she picked his brain about the modern world. She brimmed with endless questions like a hyper-curious child. Only instead of asking why the sky was blue or where babies came from, she asked why 9/11 happened and where society's progressive attitude came from, still in awe that a black man was president and gay marriage was legal. There's been a shit ton of progress, but don't go thinking we're in some kind of liberal wonderland, he said. There are still parts of America where I'd be scared to flaunt my fabulosity. They were in her study that day, Kenzie at the desk and Una nestled into the bay window, 3 floors up, high enough to spy the tops of the park's snow-covered trees across the way. Is it rude or weird if I ask? Awkward hand motions. How long I've known I'm gay? When I came out? He nodded like he'd been expecting this. Yeah. Known as long as I could remember. Didn't really come out as much as coaxed out by my lesbian mothers when I was 10. There was this popular show on at the time, Blossom, and I practically wallpapered my room with posters of Joey Lawrence, one of the stars. So it was pretty obvious. Una smiled along with him, as if tapping into his memory. Did you get picked on at school? Not that much, surprisingly. Sometimes when you're sure of who you are, it's kind of, I don't know, protects you in some way. And I hung with a more alternative crowd, so that helped. Plus, nobody messed with me because of my moms. They were fierce women.
Were?
Yeah. He plucked at his sweater, collected invisible lint.
They both died a while back. Drunk driver. No real extended family, so I've been on my own since then.
Oh, Kenzie. No wonder he'd formed such an attachment to her and her mother. No wonder he was so attuned to her loneliness. His mellow presence was a balm. Even when they sat staring into their respective laptops for hours, taking turns picking what music to play.
My turn for a question.
Kenzie cocked his head.
Why haven't you asked me about your money? Aren't you curious about how you made all these millions and how you spend them? Don't you want to know what I do day to day when I'm not going out for bagels and explaining stuff like apps and podcasts? Just yesterday, you asked a bunch of questions about the Mars rover and reality TV and the Da Vinci Code. Nice to see you're making your way through the 2000s, by the way. And we talk about more serious things, too, like AIDS and climate change. But you've never asked about the market crash of 87, or the subprime mortgage crisis, or anything related to economics or your investments. How come?
I don't know. Her shrug was noncommittal.
Come on. You went to school for this, even when you were a kid. Didn't your dad teach you in Dorothy Hamill hair?
Pam, she snapped. Her name is Pam. And that haircut looked cute on her.
Sorry, Pam.
His tone softened.
Didn't he teach you and Pam about interest rates, playing some board game?
Payday. He got it the summer I was 11. Pam and I would play for hours, and when we got tired of it, we'd make up our own games pretending to be bankers. A bitter smile curled her lips. That was a couple of months before Dad died. I still remember what the box looked like. The cover said, "Where does all the money go?" She looked at Kenzie with weary eyes. I used to care where the money went. What does it matter now? Game over.
You need to care, or you won't have all this.
He swept an arm around the room.
Didn't your letter mention the binder?
Yeah, but with everything else going on, I couldn't handle the thought of doing homework.
Don't all of a sudden hide your geek roots and act like you hate doing homework.
His voice dropped to a dramatic hush.
I think you're ready. Come with me.
Kenzie led her to one of the bookshelves and removed an armful of hardbacks, revealing a small safe built into the wall.
The combination is 6 left, 28 right, 63 left. I keep telling you, using Dale's birthday for all your security needs isn't the best idea, but whatever.
There was a metallic click, and the safe opened. Kenzie pulled out a black 3-ring binder.
What else is in there? Una asked. Nothing. And to be honest, this thing would be useless to any thieves without a time machine. But you're allowed your foibles.
Back at the desk, Kenzie opened the binder, which was filled with sheet protectors. Each plastic sleeve contained a single piece of paper and had a tab with a year on it.
You know how you don't keep diaries? Well, this is kind of a money diary. Each year shows the stocks you bought and sold, winners of big sporting events, and any relevant socio-political events affecting the economy. This is your homework. There's no telling which year you'll leap into next, so you need to be prepared for any of them.
Assuming this leaping business is real.
It's real. Trust me. Trust you.
Trust me. It's me.
If nothing else, memorize everything about Apple, Microsoft, and M&T Bank.
She glanced at the first page, following Apple through the years. 1983. October. Apple. AAPL. Buy limit order at $21. Wait for stock to split in 1987. 1987. July. Apple. AAPL. Stop loss order at $60. Will take effect in 1991. 1991. April. Apple. AAPL. Buy limit order at $17. Wait for stock to split in 2000. 2000. July. Apple. AAPL. Stop loss order at $60. Will take effect in August. 2000.
August. Buy limit order at $15. Will take effect in December. Wait for stock to split in 2005. Jesus. How many times did this stock split? She asked.
4.
And just last year, it split 7-1. Holy shit. Her eyebrows shot up.
Holy shit is right. If you invested $1,000 in Apple in 1995, you'd have something like $95,000 today. You invested way before that, and more than $1,000.
There's something I don't get, she said. If I use limit orders and stop losses, the stocks are bought and sold automatically. So where do you come in?
I do some of the less glamorous work, like market trend research, bookkeeping, taxes. I also make some of my own trades. Your portfolio might look fishy if there aren't losses reported, so I keep it real. And I balance your capital gains with your charitable contributions. Sounds sexy, huh? That's where a lot of my time goes. There are countless good causes, and your millions can't help them all.
But I do help some. A lot. At her hopeful smile, he offered a list.
Military veterans, the homeless, animal rescues, special needs children, refugees from war-torn countries. Then there's all the medical research you help fund. Cancer, AIDS, Parkinson's, you name it.
Wow. She stood a little taller.
That's not all. There's this thing called crowdfunding, where people set up websites to get donations over the internet. Some have a serious financial crisis, like medical bills or impending foreclosures, and some are looking to fund a creative project. Comic book, movie, etc. You've even put money toward a museum celebrating Nikola Tesla. I did too, because Tesla was the bomb. Anyway, I try to make sure these people are legit, but you don't care. You're like the frickin' Oprah of Kickstarter and GoFundMe.
Oprah Winfrey. I know that one. Recognition flashed in her eyes, and she pointed a finger around the room, shouting, "You get a car! You get a car! You get a car!" He laughed.
Exactly. It's insane how much money you give away.
It sounds like fun. I'd like to see these websites.
You will.
Kenzie closed the binder. Aren't you gonna make me do my homework first?
No, I'm putting this away. And you're putting that,
a nod at her laptop,
away.
She offered an agreeable shrug. Park?
No park. It's almost February, and we haven't left a 5-block radius in weeks. We don't have to go far, but we could at least explore the city.
It was something her mother would say, though Kenzie's adventurous spirit was less daunting. You don't. She began to formulate an argument, but could only conjure feeble excuses. You're right. I'll go put on some shoes.
Great. But before that, could you do your Oprah for me again?
They got the obvious things out of the way first. The Brooklyn Bridge, the Met, MoMA, the American Museum of Natural History, Central Park, Rockefeller Center, Times Square. It looks like a sci-fi movie, Una exclaimed. The Statue of Liberty, from a distance, because she refused to ride the ferry. For posterity, she bought a small souvenir statue for her display case. At the top of the Empire State Building, Una gazed south, and her heart went somber at the sight of a single skyscraper standing in place of the Twin Towers. Did you know one of the towers had a bar called the Greatest Bar on Earth? She told Kenzie. Dale always talked about bringing me there once I turned 19. That was the drinking age back then. She closed her eyes and tilted up her chin to meet a gust of wind that blew back her hair like a flag.
I knew someone who worked there, as a waiter at Windows on the World.
Was he a friend?
More than that. I was in New York the summer before my senior year of high school, a few months before the planes hit,
Kenzie said.
We met in Washington Square Park and hit it off. He was 19, wanted to be an actor. We spent a week together and did sort of a long-distance thing when I went back to Boston. Emailed, IM'd, and called a lot.
He ran a hand up and down his arm, as if massaging a sore muscle. He worked the breakfast shift so he could go on auditions.
Una whipped her head toward him. Was he there that morning?
Something sharp flickered across Kenzie's eyes. Yeah, I think so. I never heard from him after that. For a while, I told myself he found out I lied about my age. Got freaked out I was 17, not 18. And that's why he stopped talking to me. He was never online, so I told myself he blocked me. I thought about looking up the list of names.
Kenzie chewed his lower lip.
But I haven't, because
that leaves a chance he might still be alive.
Yeah. He meant a lot to me. I'd rather not think of him as a victim of something so awful.
God, Kenzie. She pulled him into a long hug. Why didn't you tell me this before when I asked you about 9/11? He stepped back and jerked a shoulder up.
I don't know. You were so caught up in your own grief. I didn't think you'd want to hear about it.
Shameful tears sprang to her eyes.
I'm still caught up in my own grief. But I won't let that make me a crappy friend.
In the months that followed, her friendship with Kenzie deepened. Between their outings, playing catch up with the decades, and studying the binder, she usually had enough to keep from being swept away by wistfulness for her earlier life. But sometimes nostalgia would deal her a mean sucker punch, like the one afternoon in April when she and Kenzie were walking around Little Italy. There were more souvenir shops and fewer restaurants than she remembered, but as they reached the intersection of Mulberry and Hester, she gasped and pointed across the street.
Oh my God, Cafe Napoli is still here?
Dale took me there on our second date. Do you want to go inside? Run far away?
Concern folded Kenzie's forehead.
No. It looks fancier now.
Staring up at the gold and black signage, she blinked until the tears receded.
Did I tell you how Dale and I met? Tell me again.
A month before my junior year of high school, I was in a bookstore reading the latest Rolling Stone. This guy came up to me. Sleepy eyes, rockabilly hair, leather jacket, super cute. And just started talking to me about music. Asked me what bands I was into. Teased me for liking Pink Floyd. But then we bonded over Velvet Underground. He introduced himself, and when we shook hands, her face softened into a dreamy smile. I knew. This was it. He was it. He asked if he could give me his address, if I'd write to him, even though he lived in Brooklyn. I agreed. And Dale handed me a piece of paper that already had his name and address on it, with "Guy from Bookstore" written on top. We exchanged a few letters, and when school started again, I saw him in the hallway. He was a year ahead of me. I don't know how I hadn't noticed him before. He finally asked me out, and our first date was dinner and a movie. Fried calamari at Rocco's, followed by Private Benjamin. Though, of course, they hadn't watched much of the movie. As soon as the lights were dimmed, their lips sought each other's out. Months of anticipation overshadowing any inhibitions. Their kisses tasted of marinara sauce. Bright light burst behind Una's closed eyelids, and the hairs on her arms stood on end as everything around them faded to black. And for our second date, he took me for dinner in Chinatown, followed by dessert. Right here. Una gave Kenzie a fortified look that promised she wouldn't cry. That's when he told me he was starting a band and wanted me to be in it. By that point, I was so in love. He could have told me he was starting a circus and I would have joined it. And I'm sure you would have made a damn fine trapeze artist or lion tamer. That was something about Kenzie she cherished. He could always brighten a situation without disrespecting its emotional weight. A final look at the restaurant's window, and she nodded up the block. Want to check out Chinatown? I could go for some wonton soup. When he wasn't working for Una, Kenzie wrote freelance articles for music blogs and often got free concert tickets. It took a bit of coaxing, but in the late spring, he convinced Una to see a folk rock band play a small club in Williamsburg. The music was decent, and she enjoyed the show while fighting invasive what-if thoughts, wondering about her own short-lived music career, staving off resentment at being relegated to a spectator. In the cab home, Una channeled her irritation into something less existential and more tangible. "What's the deal with all the phones?" she asked Kenzie. "It was so annoying, having all these little screens reflect the performance on stage. You were done taking photos for your article after a minute. Some people were recording the whole thing. Does everybody have a music blog?" He chuckled. "Probably not. But they do have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter." "Right. And people have to share everything they do in order to feel important. Or to feel a sense of community. Like I said, social media is complicated. And cluttered. There's so much white noise and distraction. The girl next to me didn't even watch the show. She spent the whole time texting. I get why people are so obsessed with their phones." Turning hers over in her hands, she still couldn't wrap her head around all its capabilities. It seemed inconceivable something so small offered endless information and convenience. "I just wonder if it's making us a little lazy and rude. How much real life do people miss out on because they're focused on a screen? How much have I missed out on?" She put her phone away. "It's an epidemic, but you're a special case, and you're mastering the art of living in the moment. #truth. Maybe not mastering, but Una did her best in the following months. She spent more time attending concerts and other local events with Kenzie, and less time behind her screens. One day in September, they went to an art installation in Williamsburg called Hirith. A series of rooms showcased family portraits spanning multiple eras, the heads swapped out for mirrors so the viewer became part of the picture. As Una's reflection joined these families across time, her somber face matched the painted ones around her. In the last room, a digital screen took up an entire wall. Above it, pink neon script spelled out, "Hirith, homesickness for something that never was and never could be." The screen reflected whoever stood before it and warped them, swapping their heads with the people beside them, changing their hair or skin color. Una stood transfixed and marveled at the different permutations of her image. But when it morphed into a version freakishly identical to herself at 18, she snapped her eyes shut and covered them with her hands. "I can't take any more." Kenzie put an arm around her and led her outside. She spent the next week in bed, silent, immobile. Every night before bed, she told herself, "Tomorrow I'll be home." Every morning, her hope waned. What if she'd never returned to her true time, her true self? What if she remained trapped in her own future? On her good days, she thought of herself as a truncated female Rip Van Winkle and treated the decades of catch-up as an embraceable challenge. On her bad days, she was an interloper in a foreign country, a prisoner in a foreign body. As temperatures dropped and daylight hours shortened, she fought the fog of depression, pushed through, kept it at bay with anticipation that the following year would bring her to a better place, a better time. Madeline decided to spend the latter half of December at a yoga retreat in Java and urged her daughter to join her, but Una declined. She remained averse to traveling beyond the city limits and was apprehensive about ringing in the new year far from home, not knowing what to expect at the stroke of midnight. On New Year's Eve, she made mulled wine with Kenzie, piercing oranges with cloves and setting them afloat in a sea of red wine, brandy, cinnamon, and nutmeg. The chai of boozy beverages, they agreed. They took turns stirring the pot, adding amber dollops of honey until the mixture was just right, then sat in Una's library beside the fireplace, drinking mugs of the stuff.
"Are you excited about your next leap?" Kenzie asked. "If it means waking up from all this, yes. I'm excited to resume my old life, with my friends and my boyfriend and my band.
take that semester off, go on tour. Of all the things I missed, school wasn't one of them. A long sip while he measured his words.
Let's say you don't wake up. Let's say this time travel stuff is real, and the next leap isn't to the 80s. Can you handle that possibility?
Not if it's another leap forward. I'm not ready to be a 20-year-old in a senior citizen's body. Una inhaled the fragrant scent of her wine, savored how heavy it felt on her tongue. But if I go back to an earlier part of my life and get to live out a year when I'm younger, that might not be so bad. If nothing else, it might convince me I'm not crazy.
You're not. You'll see.
Una regarded Kenzie. Would it be years before she saw him again? Or moments? Something tugged inside her at the thought of leaving him behind. Had she been a good friend to him, all things considered? She tried, but she could have done better. They spent the final moments of 2015 in her study, nursing mulled wine, which left a fuzzy coating on Una's tongue and made her warm and woozy. In her lap was the framed photo from the 1982 New Year's party. If only she could will herself back there. What's next? Will I continue as a tourist in my own life? Will any of it ever make sense? She watched the clock and prayed she'd been told the truth about her strange circumstances. Prayed her blind optimism wouldn't prove fruitless. She vowed not to be ruled by nostalgia and grief after this year. Wherever and whenever she ended up next, she'd make the most of it. At 11:59 p.m., she sat back in her chair and gripped the armrests as if preparing for a turbulent flight. She closed her eyes, tensed her body, took a deep breath, and held it. Part 3. Let's Go Crazy. 1991. 27. 20. Chapter 7. An immersion of sound. White noise that could have been breaking waves pounding rocks instead of the roar of cheering. People surrounded Una, pressed against her in a darkness punctuated with purple and white strobe lights. A haze of smoke, a blizzard of confetti. The crowd bled into a blur of wild eyes, dark lips, bright teeth. It enveloped her from all sides, a human vice tightening. She pushed her way through the masses like a dull needle piercing stiff fabric. A new noise filled the space. Electronic beeps and a clanging of metal on metal joined by a bass and drums. As she wove an escape path, the frenzy surrounding her grew. Dancing limbs were new obstacles to maneuver.
"Excuse you!"
someone shouted when she accidentally elbowed them. Once she got clear of the crowd, it became evident it had been propping her up. Her limbs were rubbery, and she grabbed a wall to keep from falling over. She adjusted her eyes to the darkness, but it was still like peering at a smudged aquarium tank. Not much she could make out through the blurs and trails, the images swimming before her. Am I drunk? She hadn't been a heavy drinker in her teens. A vodka cranberry with Dale here and there, a beer at a party, champagne on New Year's. And in 2015, she'd rarely exceeded 2 glasses of wine. Even on nights she felt especially lost and lonely. But this was more than a light buzz. She felt loose the way alcohol made her feel loose, but less in control of her movements, unable to steady her vision. She felt altered. I'm fucked up. No way to tell what was coursing through her body. Excuse me. Her hand was incredibly heavy, but she latched onto the arm of a passerby, a girl in a transparent raincoat and white pageboy wig.
What year is it?
She could barely speak, her words low and garbled, and she had to repeat the question several times before she was understood. The girl grinned.
You must be more messed up than I am. It's 1991. Happy New Year.
Goodbye, 2015,
Hello, 1991. A heady surge like a bright yellow light flooded through Una. Her mouth opened wide, caught between wonder, laughter, and confused joy. I know the when. On to the where. Down a red-lit hallway, she gripped the side of the wall, made steady progress until she tripped over a pair of feet. She clutched at the first thing she found to keep from falling. A shoulder. Oops, sorry. Her vision and hearing became more focused, but balance was still a bitch. What kind of stupid shoes am I wearing? The shoulder keeping her from tipping over belonged to a man in his 20s, a hair taller than her and well-built, with a square jaw and brown curls falling into his eyes. He took hold of her arm to steady her.
Don't worry about it. I don't need all 10 toes.
Una looked down, adjusted her stilettoed foot so the heel was no longer planted on the man's shoe.
Oh, wow. Sorry again.
Her tongue still too big in her mouth, too slow to form words.
Where's the exit?
I can't tell you.
Why not?
Because if you leave, I can't buy you a drink. Give me 5 minutes, if only to make up for my lost toe.
His crooked smile triggered a dimple. Una was still disoriented, but the light within her glowed brighter when she stared at him. The smart thing would be to get her bearings and go home, or at least somewhere safe and quiet. Sober up, figure out what to do next. But the way this man looked at her, enticing and a little dangerous, made her forget about being smart. Nobody had looked at her that way in a year. Not since before. And a year was such a long time to be alone. Invisible.
Okay, you can buy me a drink. But I need to find a bathroom first.
He pointed down the hall.
Second door on the left. I'll be here. Promise not to run out on me?
His curls undulated before her, and she blinked slow and long.
I promise.
As she wobbled toward the restroom, a guy in a camouflage vest brushed by her.
Sorry, beautiful, he said.
Beautiful? This she had to see. In the bathroom, a poster advertised an upcoming party. Bloody Valentine's, at a Chelsea club called Pandora's Box. Where the freaks fly high. Beside it, a beaky-nosed woman in a mini-dress made of aqua feathers teased her hair into a big black cloud.
Are we in Pandora's Box?
Una asked.
Yep. You know it's a good party when you forget where you are.
The woman waved a comb at Una's mouth.
Girl, that lipstick is out of this world. You get it at Patty Field's?
Probably. She angled toward the mirror for a look and gasped.
Holy shit.
I'm pretty. The woman gave a throaty cackle.
I wish I reacted like that when I looked in a mirror.
Giving her hair a final fluff, she turned on her heel, leaving two feathers in her wake. No wonder men were ogling her. Hell, she couldn't stop ogling herself. Her face was wrinkle-free, youthful, and painted to draw attention. Electric blue eyeliner, thick fake eyelashes, cherry red lips that glittered and matched her hair, which was worn in two long ponytails. Her slim, sexy figure was squeezed into a purple velvet tuxedo jacket over black fishnets. It was over the top, garish, and she only vaguely recognized the face in the mirror. But she'd never felt so damn alluring in her life. A quick check of her wrist confirmed the MDCR hourglass tattoo was still there. But never mind the tattoo. Back to the mirror. Back to the reflection. Mesmerizing. Incredible. Better not blink in case her 51-year-old self reappeared behind the glass.
I'm young.
She touched her cheek.
Not that young, honey,
said a drag queen in a pink sequined turban from behind her.
You're looking late, maybe mid-20s at the youngest, which is 100 in club years. I'm 20. That's young.
Me too.
Una's eyes lit up.
It's my 20th birthday.
At least on the inside. The queen squinted at her.
Yeah, Keep telling yourself that.
She reapplied her lipstick and left before Una could retort. It didn't matter. The catty queen didn't bother her. Nothing bothered her. Her blood flowed in glorious, surging waves. Secret hot coals glowed in her bones, and she would not be a slave to numbers and calendars. Not tonight. She was young again. Closer to who she used to be. Closer to her true age. Right then, nothing else mattered. Well, one other thing mattered. The sexy stranger waiting for her down the hall. She rushed out of the bathroom, tottering as quickly as her heels would allow. "You're still here," she said with too much enthusiasm.
"And you came back. I wasn't sure if the bathroom was a ruse to run away."
"I just needed to splash some water on my face," she lied. "The crowd, the heat, the noise, it was all getting to me. I had to catch my breath."
Quick double check to ensure he was as cute as she'd first thought through her narcotic blur. She could make her eyes behave now. And yes, even cuter.
A moment to admire the sharp line of his nose and his pale blue eyes, like the Velvet Underground song.
"Do you feel better now?" he asked.
"Like a new person." His mouth curled in a lazy way that made the coals in her bones glow brighter.
"Let's get you that drink, then."
An outstretched hand, eyebrow raised in a challenge. She took it without hesitation, a grip that meant business.
"We'll never get past the crowd at the main bar, so I'll take us to a VIP room."
"Oh, I didn't realize I was with a VIP. I would have curtsied or something." Her smile, equal parts sarcasm and lust.
"Aren't you a little firecracker?"
A hungry wolf flash of his eyes.
"Let's go. This way. Careful going up."
After ascending a narrow metal staircase, they emerged on a catwalk suspended over a dance floor. "Can we stop and watch for a while?" she shouted over a techno song's crescendo.
"If you want."
What is this place? And why am I here? From her vantage point, she gauged the space as a converted warehouse. Below, a shimmering kaleidoscope of bodies trailed dazzling colors on the dance floor. At the opposite end was a stage where performers with duct tape covering their private parts juggled and swallowed lit torches. Occasionally, one would spit fire. Before Una's altered gaze, the flames made filigree patterns of orange, red, and yellow. Fireworks in slow motion, hot tongues teasing one another.
"Ladies and gentlemen, freaks and freakettes, you're one hot crowd, but you're getting a little too hot."
A disembodied voice boomed through a megaphone.
"It's time to cool down, which means it's time for Flying Fiona."
A pale, petite, bald woman came out to hoots and hollers, naked except for a white thong. She turned and showed off a scarred back as two assistants came out carrying cables attached to hooks.
"What are they gonna do to her?"
Una's knees buckled. A firm hand caught the small of her back.
"Exactly what you think. Don't watch if you're squeamish. You shouldn't miss the final effect, though. I'll tell you when it's safe to look again."
Curls tickled her face when he leaned in to ask.
"So you want to tell me your name? Or should I just call you Red?"
She tilted her face toward his, stubble prickling her cheek. But she relished the sensation. Craving more textures, she put a hand on his arm, tried to absorb the silk through her fingers. Cool. Slick. She stroked the fabric, almost forgot there was an arm under it, and moved her mouth to his ear.
"Red is fine."
Red was better. No need to be Una tonight. Another wave of heat as he moved closer and pulled her in. Her tongue darted out, eager to taste the tender skin of his earlobe, suck on it. When this elicited a positive murmur, she continued down to his neck. Her hands were aimless wanderers, traversing the sea of his shirt, up to his shoulders, across his back. She needed more sensation, more textures, more tastes, more. His hand skimmed the back of her neck, and a rush of animal need spiraled through her.
"If you don't let me kiss you right now," he said,
I'm gonna throw myself off this catwalk.
The words barely made it out before Una pressed her mouth open against his, tasting gin and cigarettes on his tongue. His hand crept beneath the hem of her velvet jacket, stroked her upper thigh. She kept her eyes open. She wanted to see everything. It's like I'm in a crazy movie or music video. On stage, the assistants hooked cables into the woman's scarred back and raised her off her feet. A push, and she sailed over the crowd holding a bucket. Each time she went flying, she threw its contents onto the people below. She doused them with silk flowers, glitter, confetti, water. When the assistants took her down, her back was streaked with blood. On the catwalk, Una and the stranger continued to devour each other, lost in sloppy kisses and roaming hands. A full year since she'd kissed a man. Famished for affection, she'd kissed this man raw until... A tap on her shoulder.
Excuse me, kids, I gotta get by.
A man in a bodysuit covered with paper butterflies made impatient circles with his hand. Una and her companion separated to let him through. The stage was now empty.
Is there more to the show?
Show's just getting started, Red. Come on.
He pulled her off the catwalk and down a corridor to an unmarked door, up more stairs to a roped-off area where a dozen people mingled, most paired off and in various stages of foreplay. The space overlooked the dance floor, a ledge jutting out high above it like an afterthought, dotted with low tables and leather couches. A board bouncer nodded and unlatched the rope. Una's companion led her around the clusters of amorous duos to the bar, where two flutes of champagne awaited them. Adding alcohol to the intoxicants already in her system? Probably not smart. Water would be more sensible. But why interrupt the flow of the moment? The elation of returning to her younger body. The confirmation of her sanity. This needed to be celebrated. She was the girl in the movie who has reckless fun with a handsome stranger, and that girl doesn't choose water over champagne. They clinked glasses and downed the bubbly as if doing tequila shots. Taking her hand, the man led Una around a bend, where the VIP area curved into an L shape. A shorter ledge with a single empty couch faced a DJ booth suspended in a giant, transparent bubble 20 feet away.
Nobody's gonna bother us here.
The man sat in the center of the couch, stretched his legs out. Una remained standing, taking in his admiring gaze, his hands running up and down the sides of her legs. The music changed, a sound like robots playing with children's instruments. A fast, heavy drumbeat echoed the rhythm of Una's heart, thrummed under her skin. The pale blue eyes invited her to come closer. She obliged, straddled him. Her thirsty fingers continued their exploration across silk, leather, stubble, skin. He was keener to explore with his mouth, beginning with her lips and continuing down to the tender spot where her jaw met her throat, farther down to the groove of her collarbone. She arched her back, delicious synapses firing inside her. Strobe lights flashed, created a slow-motion illusion of their movements. Una undid the top button of her jacket, revealed a black lace bra. The man buried his face in her cleavage, ran a tongue down its center. Over the sound system, a remix of Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Relax started up, prompting the writhing duo to laugh.
"Do you think the DJ can see us?" Una asked.
"Oh yeah, and this song is definitely for us. We better put on a good show."
Una unbuttoned her jacket the rest of the way and tossed it aside. The man had big hands, his touch slightly rough, igniting her skin like a match across a striker strip. In her haste, she fumbled with the buttons of his shirt and popped one. He tugged his arms out of the sleeves without removing his tongue from her mouth. Red and yellow laser lights painted stripes across their bodies like technicolor zebras.
"Do a bump with me. That'll make it even hotter."
He removed a small brown vial from his pocket, unscrewed the top, and poured out a mound of white powder onto the webbing between his thumb and forefinger. A quick sniff, and he poured more, gestured to Una. Cocaine? it would have been wise to verify. Wiser still to politely decline. But the girl who doesn't say no to champagne doesn't ask what the powder is. She inhales. So that's what Una did. Sharp and clean, a jolt like a shot of espresso. She clenched her jaw and swallowed hard. Everything looked and tasted and felt so good. The man took one of her ponytails in each hand and pulled her back down to him, mouth open, tongue waiting to meet hers again. He grew hard, grinding against her, and Una unzipped his pants to release him, unconcerned who besides the DJ might see them. She was lost in her hunger for more, had to pour gasoline on the fire simmering within her. The stranger put his hand between her legs, tore a hole through her fishnets, and moved aside her underwear. A finger inside her, and yes, exactly what she wanted, to be filled up after an abstinent year. Except a finger wasn't enough. Her brain's pleasure center was so overloaded, it missed the pragmatic memo as to whether unprotected sex with a nameless stranger pushed the boundaries of recklessness too far. The flicker of caution was quickly extinguished, any lingering concern wiped out the second he was inside her, swept further away with each upward thrust of his hips. "I'm going to come," she groaned after only a minute. Behind closed eyes, colors flashed as her mind's light show took over.
"Good girl. Come hard for me. Do it."
He lifted his hips to meet hers, tugged down her bra, took a nipple between his teeth. Her moans were lost over the frenetic cacophony of music, a gospel choir singing over factory noises. She felt like she was in a warm bath, shot through with a mild electric current. Her body twisted into a tight knot of anticipation, then burst free, releasing the pressure in a flood. More than pleasure. Relief, like sleeping for a full day after a bout of insomnia. The orgasm brought a clarity to her high, honed its blurry edges. "What the hell am I doing?" Her capricious urge abated. She waited for him to finish before climbing off him and readjusting her clothing.
"That was fun."
He zipped up his pants. "Would you excuse me for a minute?" She didn't promise she'd come back, and he didn't ask her to. "I didn't cheat on Dale. Dale is dead, has been for years." She swallowed down nausea. As she left the VIP area, someone knocked into her, spilled a drink across her chest. Una kept walking. At the top of the stairs, she checked her pocket for a tissue and found a post-it with her handwriting. "Tonight, you'll meet a curly-haired guy with pale blue eyes. Do not have sex with him." Chapter 8. Una turned over the post-it. "You're here with boyfriend Crosby. Tall, blue hair, red tux jacket. Great guy. Find him. Full letter at home." Up until now, as with the last leap, none of it had felt real. All of this was happening to somebody else. A puppet whose strings Una was at the end of, whose marionette skin she inhabited. No wonder it was so easy to make questionable decisions. Like leaving a mess in a hotel room. Someone else would come clean it up. Except she was both the careless rock star trashing the room and the maid. The puppet and the one pulling the strings. Accountability was unavoidable. A glance at the inside of her wrist. MDCR. Madeline. Dale. Crosby? The first step in sorting through this mess, finding the bathroom. Una launched down a flight of stairs, snagged her heel, and nearly did a nosedive. She twisted an ankle but caught the banister before gravity caused further harm. In the restroom, she inspected the damage. It was like she had to cover up someone else's crime. A dead body foisted upon her, and she had no choice but to bury it. The lower half of her face smeared red like she'd been sucking face with a clown. Traces of white powder beneath her nose, jacket buttoned crookedly with one breast threatening full exposure. She tucked it back in and adjusted her clothing. In her other jacket pocket was a compact and tube of lipstick. She made use of both, then fixed her smudged eyeliner. Her eyes were bloodshot, frenzied, her jaw tight. Her brain a runaway horse, with her barely able to hold on to the reins. All she could do now was find Crosby. How long had they been separated? No clocks anywhere. Locating him wouldn't be easy. Hundreds of people swarmed the three-story club, which was permeated with dark corridors, staircases, and alcoves. It could be a while before she caught sight of her boyfriend. Maybe she should follow the same advice given to hikers lost in the woods. Stay in one place. Surely Crosby was looking for her, too. Yes, that was best. She limped through the crowds in search of blue hair or a place to sit. If only she had her cell phone. It was so much easier to lose track of someone in 1991. Could he have left? She admonished her earlier self for not setting up this leap better. Drugged out in a packed club, separated from her boyfriend, the lame post-it she didn't see until it was too late. What were you thinking earlier, Una? Should she go home? She couldn't. If Crosby was as great as the note claimed, if he was the C in her tattoo, he'd keep searching and worry if she didn't turn up. Besides, what if she hadn't bought the Park Slope brownstone yet? And who knew where her mother might be living these days? As the drugs lessened their hold, euphoria was replaced with unease. She was waiting to be rescued by a stranger. All she had to go on was a name, a hair color, and the top half of an outfit. Oh, and that he was a great guy, one she'd just cheated on. At a lounge area overlooking the dance floor, Una searched the crowd for blue hair. Violent flashes of white light and sweeping green lasers made it impossible to make out anyone. She found an ottoman to perch on and scrutinized everyone who walked by, fidgeting like a little kid after too much chocolate. Under other circumstances, she would have enjoyed the people watching. Shirtless men in leather harnesses led around on leashes. Sparkling, statuesque drag queens. Couples in corsets and waistcoats, right out of a Victorian portrait. But rather than savor the eye candy, she scanned the passersby with impatience and disappointment. No one matched the description in her note. Before long, a tall man in a red tuxedo jacket rushed over and knelt beside her.
Jesus, Una, where did you go?
His voice couldn't decide between anger and concern. I fell down the stairs and hurt my ankle. Tears poured down her powdered cheeks like expert skiers down a fresh snowbank. Crosby examined her ankle, as if he could do anything but note it was swollen.
I was going nuts looking for you. I thought you had a bad reaction to the E and passed out somewhere. Or worse.
He raked a hand through his blue hair. The face was new to her, but not displeasing, with intense brown eyes and angular, androgynous features. At least earlier Una has good taste.
I'm fine, I just want to go home, she said. I'll get our coats.
No way, I don't want to be separated again. Though she didn't know him, she instantly imprinted on Crosby like a baby duck. He helped her to her feet.
We'll need to go slow, she said.
You and your crazy shoes.
He shook his head and supported her as she leaned on him. They got their coats and made their way outside, onto a side street lined with more warehouses.
Stay where you are. I'll get us a taxi, Crosby said.
Why not an Uber? The surge pricing will be ridiculous, but it'll be faster.
I don't understand anything you just said.
She clamped a hand over her mouth. Right. 1991.
I don't either. I had a drink at the club and maybe someone put something in it. I feel kind of sick.
Crosby gave her a quick hug and kissed the top of her head.
I'm sorry. This is all my fault. You said coming here was a bad idea, but I insisted. Hang tight. I'll get us home.
His kindness brought forth a new wave of tears, but she held them back, clenched her jaw, ground her teeth so hard it made her temples throb, a matching beat to the pain in her ankle. She glowered at her stilettos,
wondering how much tonight's footwear would contribute to her creaky joints decades from now. Eventually, Crosby hailed a taxi. He helped Una into the back seat and gave the driver an address she didn't recognize. "Are we going to my place? I'd really like to go home," Una said.
"I thought we were going back to mine tonight."
Hand up to wave away his disappointment.
"What am I saying? You're injured. Of course you want to go home."
He gave the driver a different address, but she couldn't hear it over a passing police car. Now that they were in a quieter space, Una chewed her lower lip and fended off dread. She was a body snatcher, an imposter that had to pass as her host. This meant watching every word out of her mouth, avoiding any more slip-ups. Nothing about post-1991 technology or any other knowledge she'd accumulated last year. Problem was, the drugs made her want to talk, talk, talk. Impossible to curtail the verbal deluge that slipped past the dam of her lips. "I thought I was insane the last time this happened," she blurted, scooting up against the door to look at Crosby. "Or at least, I don't know, senile or something. I had to wait a year to find out for sure, and tonight I did, and you know what? I'm not insane. I did the math, and today is my 27th birthday. I get to spend the next year being 27. She made wild gestures with her hands. "Do you have any idea how happy this makes me? I'm young!" Her elation made Crosby watch her with bemused, uncertain eyes. "And I'm here with you. And you are gorgeous. I mean, wow! You are a really, really good-looking guy, with an aura of cool about you. You've got kind of a young Jack White thing going on." A nervous laugh.
Thanks? Who's Jack White?"
"From the White Stripes. Shit. A local band I was into in high school. You're much cuter than Jack, though."
"Well, that's good. I'd hate for you to be pining over some teenage crush."
He slid over, closed the space between them. An image of Dale flickered into Una's mind, winking at her during band practice as Corey and Wayne argued about a song's tempo, crooking a finger to bring her over, only to whisper something silly into her ear. The flash in his eyes before he kissed her. The same flash now in Crosby's eyes. Crosby was her boyfriend now, and he was going to kiss her. Una put an arm out to stop him. It made no sense. An hour ago, she'd been so quick to have frivolous, drug-fueled sex with a stranger. Now, here was a stranger that actually wasn't one. Here was an attractive man who cared about her, and she wouldn't let him near her. "I'm sorry," she said. "I think hurting my ankle put me off my high. And then losing track of you and the lights and the people. It was too much. Amazing and surreal at first. But then it got weird and scary when I couldn't find you. And I wasn't sure I'd even be able to recognize you." She pressed her lips shut before anything else escaped. Taking the hint, he slid back.
"Why wouldn't you recognize me?"
"Well, you know, it was dark, and I was kind of seeing things. People looked like they had all these weird Instagram filters on them."
"Insta what? What are you even talking about?"
"I have to get out of here." They were in Brooklyn now, but how close to home? How much more time to say baffling, incriminating things? "That drink I had, I think it was laced with something," she said. "I'm sorry I'm being so weird. I don't feel like myself." At least that part wasn't a lie. Crosby reached out and rubbed the base of her neck. She stiffened, but forced herself to accept the gesture, though she wanted to squirm away. "You don't deserve his comfort." She could still feel that other man's hands on her, inside her, bringing her so much pleasure then, making her queasy now. The taxi pulled up to a familiar corner. "Oh, thank God it's the same house," she said.
"Why wouldn't it? Never mind. Hang on, I'll come around to help you out."
"I'll be fine," Really, I just need to sleep it off. She opened the car door, letting in a gust of cold air.
You don't want me to come in? We were gonna spend the night and go out for a big birthday breakfast tomorrow. I mean, I should at least be around in case. With all the drugs you took. In case you have a bad trip.
You're really one of the good ones, aren't you? She put a hand to his cheek, which was shaved smooth. I'm sorry, but I have to be alone right now. Could we postpone that breakfast?
Yeah, okay.
His voice was tight.
I'll call you tomorrow.
A stab of remorse for hurting his feelings, for the other ways she'd hurt him he wasn't even aware of. Tomorrow. She lunged forward and gave him a peck on the lips, hoping to conjure instant familiarity, a modern fairy tale curse broken to unlock the love she'd felt for him before midnight. But his lips were as foreign as the stranger's at the club. Only this mouth was a little fuller and firmer with disappointment. Once inside, Una took off her shoes and threw them across the foyer. Stupid shoes. Stupid girl. It took a beat to register the quiet of her house. The sameness of it. Same checked marble tiles. Same chandelier made of spokes and gears and crystal and light. Same blue glass vase on the entrance table, filled with white lilies. Such a sweet scent from those funeral flowers. Such relief to have some consistency. Hello? She called out. Mom? Kenzie? Silence. The kitchen should have been her first stop, for an ice pack, but instead she limped upstairs. The library was also the same, though the armchairs, red leather in 2015, were currently brown suede. A series of shivers cascaded through her body. She built a small fire and moved one of the chairs over to it. On the mantel, a sealed envelope with her name and the current year, followed by, "Do not read if under the influence." Seriously? She rolled her eyes and was distracted by the carved wooden ceiling, its ornate grooves rippling like water disrupted by a thrown pebble. A quick jerk of her head, attention forced back to the envelope, block letters wavering before her eyes. Okay. Maybe 1990 Una had a point. Better to wait, read the contents sober. But